What up, meepsters? This is Ryan Rainbro, and if you're hearing this, that means you're about to listen to one of the 99 free episodes of the Meep Meep Podcast, available wherever you cast pods. But keep in mind that there are new and unreleased episodes of the show on patreon.com/meepmeeppod. So you'll want to sign up there to hear future episodes and also other side projects like Choo Choo, the show about soundtracks, and contribute suggestions for future episodes as well. Will I listen to your suggestion? There's only one way to find out. patreon.com/meepmeeppod. Bye! What up, meepsters? I'm Ryan Rainbro, and on this episode, we're getting a spooktacular. That's right, Famous Monsters, the 1999 release by The Misfits, and we're speaking to the infamous Michael Graves all about it. You see, The Misfits, for a lot of their career, were fronted by a gentleman by the name of Glenjamin Danzig. You may know him from his band, Danzig, who I saw in 2002 touring off an album called 777, which I don't know if that was supposed to be evil or righteous gemstones. But in between then, in the 90s, the Misfits were reborn as a new monster.
Very famous.
With Michael Graves fronting them, Dr. Chud drumming them, who you may remember from a previous episode on 2001's Cuts from the Crypt, as well as Doyle Von Frankenstein, Vegan Power, and Jerry Only, former WCW wrestler. And so we're going to be talking to Michael all about making this record, going from the first record he was on, American Psycho from 1997, banger, leaving the band temporarily as Mike Hideous fronted him, and then coming back and making Famous Monsters. And one of the things we talk about is the song Scream, which they wrote to be a part of the Scream 2 soundtrack, starring another World Championship Wrestling alumni, actually former World Championship Wrestling heavyweight champion, David Arquette. And not only was he in the movie, he's on the soundtrack. He did make the cut. Misfits didn't make it. Year 2000, David Arquette's band did make it. Now, they wrote the song Scream to be a single for the movie Scream 2, the sequel, but it was not chosen as a single. You know what was chosen? That's right. Suburban Life by the Cottonmouth Kings. Which featured Doug Carrion, who was in, what was it, Dag Nasty? He was in Humble Gods. I think he was in Doggy Style as well. He's in that band now that pretends to be Dag Nasty in a very Operation Mindcrime situation. What are they called? They're called, oh man, Field Day. They're called Field Day. And I wish them well. Yo, but if you think cancel culture is crazy now, the Suburban Life music video was on the Scream 2 DVD release, and there's a section of the song where the Cottonmouth Kings are talking about their disc jockey, Bobby B, who was also toured with Methods of Mayhem, I'm pretty sure. But anyway, Bobby B, they refer to as the cream of the crops, okay? And crops is a double entendre here. You know, cream of the crop is, of course, a metaphor for being top-notch, which also might be a metaphor. But cream of the crops also, because the Cottonmouth Kings, you see, their whole gimmick was all they talked about, and to this day, still talk about weed, smoking it, it being legalized. They must be pretty happy because it's legal where they live in California now, so I don't know why they're still talking about it, but I also wish them well. But anyway, they refer to Bobby B as cream of the crops, referring to the weed crops, and it's censored on the DVD. The digital video disc would not let you hear the word crops. It's cream of the... And you'll never know. You'll never know unless you purchase their 1998 album, Royal Highness, and listen to it, which I did off the strength of the single Bump, which I think was actually a rock remix, because they were on the rock stations, the Cottonmouth Kings, despite being rappers, not unlike the Beastie Boys. And I'm sure that they would love that comparison and that compliment. But also on the Scream 2 soundtrack, so we got Ear 2000, David Arquette's band. We got the Cottonmouth Kings, legendary, Pakalika, rest in peace. We had John Spencer Blues Explosion. Now, I only know two things about John Spencer Blues Explosion. Number one, I know in the movie Baby Driver that Run the Jewels rap over one of Johnny's songs. I believe it's called Bell Bottoms. And it's pretty sick. LP, Killer Mike, never convicted, so name seems more like an allegation than evidence. But that's one thing that I know about John Spencer Blues Explosion. The more important thing that I know about John Spencer Blues Explosion, and actually what I know the most about John Spencer Blues Explosion, is John Spencer was in the band, as you might have guessed, and he had a little sister named Muffin Spencer, which, yes, is funny as I say it out loud, but Muffin had her own band called Brassy, and Brassy was the coolest. Now, you may have heard Brassy's song if you ever watched the show MTV Cribs on MTV. They had this song called Work It Out that would play as like the bumper music for Cribs. But they were the sickest. They put out two records, Gettin' Wise and Got It Made. I think not in that order. And their drummer was also their DJ. So when you would see Brassy live, their drummer, who was John Sweat? No, his name was DJ Sweat. He was John something. John would play the drums, right? He's hitting the drum with one hand. And then the other hand, he's cutting the record. So sick. Brassy also had this bass player named Karen Frost, which I know sounds like an X-Men character, but I think that was her real name. And I don't know why I would think it's her real name. I don't know why I wouldn't just assume that her and DJ Sweat and Muffin maybe came up with their own names, but Karen Frost played bass, and so naturally, because she was a girl that played bass, and I was a young boy who wanted to know a girl that played bass, she was the coolest. And also, Brassy had a shirt that said, Chicks Dig Bass, which I had no evidence was true, because I know that they meant bass like an 808 machine, which was on the shirt, but I got a bass guitar, and chicks weren't digging it. Okay, Brassy? Please go listen to Got It Made by Brassy. It's like punk rock and rap and electronic and MTV Cribs. All the best things. Of course, the Scream 2 soundtrack would pale in comparison to the god-tier Scream 3 soundtrack. Probably because Scream 3's soundtrack, and you can look at the back of the CD and see this is true, executive producer Creed. Scott Stapp has an executive producer credit, and it's for the Scream 3 soundtrack. No wonder they're going on a cruise next year. All that executive, that EP money. We'll have to talk about that a different time. But today, on this episode, we're talking about Famous Monsters by The Misfits, 1999. We talk about making that album. We also talk about his participation in the Roadrunner United album with Matt Heafy of Trivium fame. But we start at the beginning, and that is coming into Famous Monsters in comparison to American Psycho. Because in American Psycho, Michael's kind of the new guy in the band. But by the time Famous Monsters comes around, he's been in the band for several years. So was the approach any different coming into that record versus the other one?
No, it felt a lot different making that record. Because, like you indicated, I was still the new guy, but I had already gone through the process of writing and recording a record and producing a record for a major label. For Roadrunner was Geffen Records. And going into that, I was totally green, even from the writing process. So by the time Famous Monsters came around, I was really... You know, as a writer and a performer, probably hitting hitting stride. I felt very, very confident because of the success of American Psycho and because of the success of my contribution. So Famous Monsters felt totally different.
We'll be back after a quick break.
If you love good music and good podcasts, you'll love Roots Music Rambler. I'm Jason Falls. My co-host Francesca Folinazzo and I talk to the singers, songwriters, musicians, and more in Americana, alt-country, bluegrass, folk, blues, and beyond. We share our own takes on the latest news in the space and recommend new music for you to explore every episode. Come get to the roots of the music you love. Find us at RootsMusicRambler.com or go wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Roots Music Rambler.
And with American Psycho being so successful, and more specifically, I guess, Dig Up Her Bones being such a big hit, was there a thought of going into Famous Monsters to kind of duplicate that, to do something different? I mean, not that Misfits in their whole history, you know, veer off from the playbook too much, but were you guys trying to find another Dig Up Her Bones? Were you trying to do something specific with that? What was the goal, I guess, of that album?
Everybody, Doyle always used to say to me, Michael, we only need one. We only need one, right? You only need one, you know, hit and you're good to go. We used to laugh about that, but no, we didn't. And I didn't, I mean, you're always writing in the hopes somewhere in your mind that it's going to be a hit. But it wasn't like, all right, I'm going to write a hit. Here we go. It was more, it really was more, let's write really whatever we feel, because from American Psycho, Misfits were still in a box, hadn't released a record since 1980 something, right? It was like Earth AD was the last thing that was put out. And so you had this huge gap of time before and then American Psycho. So the band wasn't established yet. We had to reveal ourselves, and we didn't even kind of know where we were at. But so when we began to write, and when I began to write for Famous Monsters, there was this ability to just say, okay, now I know what works, and we can go even further, because the relationship that even I had, or the band had with each other, to be able to now collaborate with one another. We knew how to speak to one another. We knew how to be creative on a higher level with more confidence. So there was just, I wrote dozens and dozens of songs for Famous Monsters, and Doyle just had, hours of riffs and ideas, and Jerry came out swinging too. So there was this huge bulk of material that we had to, you know, do creative combat over to see what stuck. But that was the brilliance of that time as well, that we were able to do that. And then on the other side of it came Famous Monsters.
You tell me a little bit more about that creative combat. You're just saying that you each would bring different songs to the table, and it was kind of a battle between which ones were going to make the record. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So just like any other band, it's like, oh, well, that's too metal. This sounds lame. You know, I would always say, like, I hate saying these words. It doesn't seem right. Doesn't seem like us. Those types of things where you have to argue your case. Why is it? How is it part of the vision? Is it part of the vision? Is this what we sonically want to do? Well, it sounds like Iron Maiden. Well, do we want to sound like Iron Maiden? Do we want people to say, you know, do you want to make those connections? And that's how you glue the monster together of and taking all everybody's input at that point and being able to come out on the other side with something that everybody's into and everybody feels. And I'm saying in everybody, the band, where we could play it and play it like we mean it and be able to channel what we need to channel through. And from that, there's this. Again, there's this freedom that comes with that confidence, a confidence to be able to get to the other side of a song like Crying on Saturday Night and say, all right, we can do this. This is a really slow, it's a ballad, and it's not even a ballad like Comeback, you know, or something that you might hear off of Legacy Brutality. It was a straight up, like, you know, it was a ballad. But again, we were able to do that. We were confident enough as a band to put a song like that on the record. And Roadrunner, as well, of being a record company, gave us the confidence and the support to be that sort of band and to make a record like Famous Monsters at that time.
And do you remember why Roadrunner ended up being the label that came out on instead of Geffen again?
Geffen was at a time they were being sold, right? All the big record labels like Geffen, Capitol Records, EMI, like, you know, all the big ones, the original, it's like the original six. They were all being bought up by even bigger companies. And I was 20 something years old. So I was like the baby in the family. So I was always the last to know everything. But I remember hearing about the label being bought, and then there was a lot of bands that were going to be let go and our contracts weren't going to be renewed. Ultimately Geffen didn't keep us on, and the circles that we were touring in and hanging out with, like our peers were the New York City hardcore bands, Life of Agony, Typo Negative, Sick of It All, Madball, all of those guys. And so there was a lot of Typo Negative, for example, was on Roadrunner, one of my favorite bands ever. Pete Steele got me into the Misfits, literally. And I just remember Mike Gitter being around, and Roadrunner was blowing up at the time, and they had a lot of traction. And so I don't remember really any other focus but on any other labels. I mean, nobody ever told me, but so yeah, Roadrunner wanted it to make it happen. Also, Famous Monsters and signing to Roadrunner, it was a weird time in the band, because it preceded when I first left the band. And so there was this almost atomic bomb that went off in the band that caused all sorts of devastation around us and for me, because I was no longer in the band. I'm doing air quotes. I was no longer in the band like I was on Geffen Records. Again, the business makeup of it really didn't mean much to me, because I was 20 something years old and I just wanted to make music with and play with my friends and surf and play hockey and hang out with girls and stuff. But I knew that I was sacrificing things at that time. And so it was a weird time in the band, but it was really, really, again, exciting to be signed. I mean, I wasn't signed, but I was working for Roadrunner Records and creating this record for them, because they were the record company, Mike Gitter and the people that were on that side of the record were very, very excited for us and very supportive. But again, it was made at a crazy time, which also goes to the brilliance of the record that we were able to even pull it off.
The fact that it exists as a triumph is what you're saying.
Yeah, because there was so much tumultuous energy around us, like, you know, anger and betrayal stuff, and it came off of the time in the band where they had Mike Hideous singing. So it was a very weird time. And the four of us and Daniel Ray and Ed Stasium were able to take that energy, especially with me. You know, I can't, especially with me as a writer and as the lead guy that was, you know, really the lead creative as we were putting this together. Because I was the singer, really helped take all of that and apply it to the music like therapy. And again, why that record is so powerful, at least I think.
We'll be back after a quick break.
But you still loading them and heating them up with all your single shit you've been dropping. You feel me? Loading them up on. It only takes structure. And you know, just paying attention to the climate of the game.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
So do your homies got a role in your little, you know what I mean?
Yeah, we all artists over here, man. I'm trying to get them on there. We all artists, man. You feel me? We gonna have this like,
bro, me and my man Kai, we be like, I don't know, we play with this shit right now. I gonna lie, we play with this shit right now for real.
Don't play with it, take that shit serious.
Well, yeah, not to go backwards, but you said something that I've never heard before, and I'm sorry if you've said this a million times, but can you tell me more about Pete Steele getting you into the Misfits? Because famously, the story I know is that you're like vaguely aware that the Misfits exist, and then you kind of stumble into this audition and end up getting the gig. So I'd like to hear the reality.
I always knew that the Misfits existed. I didn't, you know, I was a young skater punk when I was a kid, so I knew the Misfits skull. Right. We had the boom boxes and the cassette tapes. And I knew like, you know, the Misfits songs when they came on, but it just, I was never just a punk or a metalhead or I was just me. Right. So I never, so I listened to a lot of music. When I came across the Misfits, I was at the right place at the right time. I was working at a studio, creating a demo with my band called the Mopes, and it just so happened that the guy that owned that studio had known the Misfits for ever since they were kids, and they had recorded a bunch of stuff there, and the Jerry and Doyle were working on this Max's Kansas City record that really never came out, and they were looking for a singer, and I came in to do vocals one day, and Bobby Alekis, the owner, says to me, "You got a really good voice." He says, I've known these guys since I was kids. They're called the Misfits and they're looking for singers. You should definitely try to call this guy and see what's up. And I remember the first thought that came to my mind is like, oh my God, I can't sing death metal, but I'm going to give it a shot. Because my mind just didn't put it together. I was listening to like Jane's Addiction and like Nirvana and Tool, stuff like that. Right. So I hadn't listened to, you know, I hadn't focused on punk, and it just escaped me anyway. So I went, I auditioned, and we went through this whole thing, like a year's worth of me singing and other people auditioning and all this crazy stuff. Okay. So October of 1994 is coming up, and we're in Bergen County, New Jersey, right over the bridge from New York City. So there's a lot of New York City hardcore music out there. And those were the circles that we ran in, you know, the shows we went to. And so the guys from Typo Negative reach out to the Misfits and say, we're headlining Roseland City Ballroom in New York City, Roseland Ballroom on Halloween. So if you guys want to come out and have your big opening, you could come out during our encore. And it was the manager of Typo Negative reached out, and Jerry and the guys are like, all right, that would be awesome, because the Misfits would then have to wait a whole nother year to relaunch. Right. So they had to make a decision. What are they going to do? The Misfits can't relaunch this whole big, huge career like November 17th. You know, it has to be Halloween.
Okay.
So they're like, all right, yeah, that sounds awesome. We'll do it, but we don't have a singer. Would Pete Steele do it? So they go back and ask Pete, and Pete goes, yeah, sure, I'll do it, but I don't know any of the songs. So then they call me and they say, hey, do you want to teach Pete Steele, or can you teach Pete Steele these songs, these Misfits songs, so that we can do it? And I'm like, are you kidding me? So Typo Negative was like my favorite band. I used to go see them. Biohazard, used to play with them. Life of Agony. And I was like, yeah, you know, and they were huge at the time. So I was like, yeah. So we go to Brooklyn and we set our stuff up. And in my mind, it's exactly as you would think. It's like Pete Steele. He's got a grinder. It's like really dark. It's candles. It's like really dank and dusty. It's weird. It's like Pete Steele's Typo Negative lair. and we start jamming and we go through a couple of the songs, Halloween, Horror Business, we're playing. And not far into the session, he stops, Pete Steele stops everything. And he puts his arm around me. He says, "This kid is your singer. What are you guys doing? He sings these songs better than I could on my best day, and probably sings it better than anyone in this room. And obviously up to this point, nobody else can sing better than him. This is your singer." And there it was. They put me on stage Halloween, and then we went over and played the after party, and that was it. You know, Pete Steele and I remained friends up to his death. So yeah, Pete Steele was he's an important dude in my life.
Well, that's incredible. I mean, what a cool story just in general, but also you're telling me you're a fan of Typo. your hero is saying, "Hey, you should put this guy in your also famous band." Going from that, where you go from kind of learning more about what their sound is, learning their songs, teaching their songs to other people, to fast forward what we're talking about, Famous Monsters in 99. And you're also talking about this musical combat you guys are going through. So when you're presenting songs for this record, what is now your understanding of what the Misfits are and what these songs should be?
Well, that was the challenge that I learned about for American Psycho. Like I had said earlier, the Misfits hadn't released a record since 1980 something. I think in 1981 or 1982, maybe Earth AD came out. So the Misfits, you know, I learned going into the band, because when I came back and I told my friends and the people that I hung out with and knew, "Hey, I'm going to go audition for the Misfits." It was like, like the record scratch, and everyone looked at me and I was like, "What the hell is going on?" You know, because I hung out with like the punk scene was at the end of the punk scene. It was starting to like the goth sort of thing was starting to happen, but there was still a New York City punk scene, and as well as a very a skinhead scene, you know, all factions of punks, all factions of skinheads, but for real. So again, now it's the early 90s, and I'm young, right? I'm just out of high school. I'm a senior in high school. Or, you know, I just graduated high school, and I hung out with kids four or five years older than me. So I knew, quote, I'm doing air quotes again, you know, real punks and real skinheads. So that was it. They were like, you know, my friends especially said, "All right, you have to understand how important this band is to this scene, right? And to this movement." And so one of the first things I got was, it was an audio tape. My friend Kylie, who's really big, beautiful punk rocker, gave me this cassette of Henry Rollins, "Get in the Van," right? And she made me listen to that. And then it was just endless, like, stories of, you know, then it was connected, like, Glenn Danzig, right? So I knew Glenn Danzig from Mother, and Glenn Danzig being famous, it was huge hit right on MTV when I was young. And so I put those together, and you know how important the Misfits were in the movement, in the punk rock scene. And then I said, "Oh my God, like, this isn't just an opportunity to get into a band that people know. This is something even bigger. Like the Misfits really meant a lot to some people." You know, there was the collector side of it, there was the punk rock side of it, and they were the fans and the people that were into the Misfits before American Psycho were very aggressive in their, "This is what the band is." And so there was all of that leading into American Psycho. When we were successful with American Psycho, both on the recording side and the live aspect of the band, we jumped so many sharks because people didn't take to me, especially. Like, I was the target because people loved Glenn Danzig. It was like David Lee Roth wasn't in the band anymore, and everyone hates Sammy Hagar, right? It's that same sort of thing. And so in the beginning, it was very difficult, but also amazing to be able to jump all those sharks and get to a place where we were at with Famous Monsters, to where we could take even more chances. We knew that we weren't a, you know, we were punk rock in our ethos, but we knew we didn't sound like punk rock. We didn't sound like the Ramones. We didn't necessarily write songs that were exactly like the Ramones because, you know, at that point when we were writing Famous Monsters, we were a band that was okay with allowing, I keep going back to the band Iron Maiden, because we listened to a lot to Iron Maiden. Doyle and I listened to a lot of Iron Maiden, like Ozzy and old, like Black Sabbath, you know, bands like that. Van Halen, we love listening to Van Halen. And in 1980 something, that wouldn't fly. We couldn't make music like that. But we knew now that we were a band that could make music like that. And whatever we were doing to it as we were squeezing it through the filters that we did, it was working. So we knew that at that time that we were a band that could do those things.
And what do you think the biggest difference between those two records are, Famous Monsters and American Psycho?
The confidence in our playing. I mean, I know for me, when I didn't know what I was doing in American Psycho, I was just like, all right, I'm just going to be like Kurt Cobain, scream my face off the whole way through, which then led to, it was a good thing that I went into it thinking that, because the producer put the brakes on. I was like, all right, hang on, and got my vocal coach, who is just genius in the industry, Don Lawrence, who taught me everything that I know. Came into the studio and taught me, you know, he had already taught me the fundamentals and the techniques of singing, vocalizing. But then he came into the studio and taught me how to sing into a microphone and how to make a tired voice work for me. He taught me how to exist in a studio. And so when Famous Monsters rolled around, I was so much closer to a PhD in recording, because I was so confident, and so when I was behind the microphone, it wasn't like, am I doing this right? Does this sound good? Like, is everyone going to laugh at me? Are they talking behind my back? I knew that I was good. I knew that I was good in what I was doing, you know, both, you know, spiritually in the songs as well as fundamentally into the microphone. The sounds that I was making and creating and were going to work.
And you mentioned earlier on, you know, that you and Doyle would kind of joke that you only need one. And we talked about what the one was from American Psycho. Is there a song on Famous Monsters you thought was going to be the one for that record?
You know, I don't think I ever did. There's a song like Saturday Night, Cry on Saturday Night. I knew that there was something there. Like, it was a cool song because it was so different. And I loved singing it because I was able to really get into the band's pocket and really swoon and use my voice, especially in the bigger venues and doing it live. But I always thought that it would maybe be a song like Pumpkinhead or something, you know, crazy like that. I mean, these are times that, like, Marilyn Manson was top of the heap. I never thought that a song like Crying on Saturday Night would be the one to make the crowd, you know, really, that's when everyone was like, yeah. Oh my God. Like, all right.
You're saying that is the reaction that song would get?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. They loved it.
It has that very, like, almost like, I don't know if I'm saying this incorrectly, but it almost feels like a doo-wop or like 50s. Like, it's got a very, like, swing to it. Maybe not the song, the music style swing, but, you know, it has that kind of
100%. Yeah. That was the point. Right, the Misfits were always connected to this 50s sort of doo-wop vibe. And Glenn did that. He sounded like Elvis. It was that very 50s sort of doo-wop-y thing, which was an important element and always had to show up in the Misfits because it was in the DNA of the band. It was in the genetics of the band because it all started with Glenn. And that's why going into, again, American Psycho and running through the byline to Famous Monsters, I always asked myself, especially before American Psycho, you know, is this something that Glenn would listen to and perhaps be proud of if I had the opportunity to explain to him why it was that way. A song like Saturday Night is specifically that. You know, it's Tears on My Pillow. It's the same. It really is the same movement.
The song I always associate with this record when I think about it is Helena.
Right.
And I thought in my mind when I got, because I know Scream ended up being the single or at least the music video. But Helena, I always thought, even like, you know, just kind of in retrospect, I think that's like the song. Do you remember coming up with that melody? Because that, like, you know, I know it's got kind of two parts. It's got like the cut off your arms and then it goes into the faster part. But that It's so catchy, the part where you're removing limbs from this poor girl.
That song came together, and Doyle would give me a cassette tape of riffs and parts, and like Frankenstein, you know, sometimes we would put them together, we would marry different things and create these songs. And Helena, the that fast part, was this one piece that he had that we were writing over. And then we were on tour and in the Winnebago. And at some point in the tour, the guy that was driving, we were in Detroit. We were leaving the venue in Detroit. It was wintertime at the time that this happened. And he drove underneath an overpass that was too low for the Winnebago to go through. And he ripped the air conditioner off of the Winnebago. So again, fast forward to the summer, and we're touring, and we're driving through like Arizona, and it's like 100-something degrees outside. We don't have any air conditioning. I don't know why we never put another air conditioner on the Winnebago ever, but we were rolling down, you know, and it was hot. It was just hot all the time, and we were in the middle of nowhere. Like when you drive through Texas, it's just nowhere and straight forever. And Doyle and I were sitting on the couch, just hot and miserable. And he had this little guitar that had all the NFL teams, the stickers all around it. And he was just going, it was probably because we were listening to Corrosion of Conformity at some point. And he's just going, and he was doing it over and over and over. And I just remember just looking at him and just starting to sing, you know, if I cut off your arms, cut me. If I cut off your arms, cut off your legs, you still love me anyway. And just staring at him and saying that and singing that over and over until he finally cracked the smile. And then it was just something. It became something. And we married that to the fast part. And that's how Helena was born.
Well, that's awesome. That seems like such an organic collaboration between the band to write a song. And in retrospect, funny circumstances. I'm sure when you were sweating in the Winnebago, it wasn't that funny. But are there other songs? I know you've kind of brought up Saturday Night a couple times, but are there other songs on this record that you're really proud of looking back on? I'm sure you're proud of all of them, but are there certain ones that kind of resonate with you more than others?
Yeah, a song like Pumpkinhead. I remember going through the process of writing those words with Doyle. And it was just, it was a really fun, really, really creative, like the sessions that we had writing, like the lyrics to that song and composing that song. Yeah. We couldn't come up with the part that's actually the chorus the refrain part. I want to take you where your body will lie. And we tried a couple of things. We couldn't figure out a chorus that worked. And there was this song that like I had played since when I was a kid. It was like 11 or 12 years old. And my friend, it was like my first band ever. And I was in a band with this kid, Dave Hogan. And he wrote this song that I still play today. And so we borrowed the chorus movement for Pumpkinhead, put it in it, and it worked perfect. And all along Famous Monsters too, it's funny. There's a couple of parts in the record where like Doyle had taken riffs or even solos and parts from the band that he and Jerry had before. They were the Misfits Reformed, called Christ the Conqueror. It was like this really metally band. And we used elements of that. And I think one of the parts in Pumpkinhead have that. If I don't know if it's the solo or something.
And with that album, since so many of the songs are just almost like pseudo theme songs for movies.
Yeah.
Was that like something that you guys would come together and be like, oh, we need to write a Die Monster Die song. And then you would like watch the movie and come up with lyrics, or did the lyrics come? You're like, oh, this kind of reminds me of whatever movie.
You know, we had this idea to have like a concept album, and it wasn't really written as a concept album, but, and I say we, again, because like me and Doyle, especially when we wrote a lot and collaborated the most, and then it was with Chud, and then it was I would collaborate with Jerry, but we had this idea as a concept that like there would be this, like my character is why I had like the big hat, right? I wanted to look, be like the circus leader, and Doyle and I came up with this concept that this crazed circus leader guy goes out and captures all the wonders of the world, like King Kong and all these, you know, different things, and makes this circus out of them, you know, Pumpkinhead. You know, like that's, again, that's where we started the how do we approach Famous Monsters. You know, how are we going to write through that lens? So yeah, we didn't want it to name every song after a movie. I always thought that was pretty lame. I thought that if it was just an entire record with just names of movies, it would kind of put us in a box, because eventually we'd run out of names of movies and then we'd have a whole other problem. So yeah, so that was the beginning mark of Famous Monsters.
Well, one song on there that is named after a movie, even though it didn't end up being a part of it, was Scream.
Right.
And you do that music video for Scream, which is also incredible. And I imagine had to be a pretty cool experience for you making this, like, I don't want to say big budget, but certainly in comparison to the prior video. And I'm sure one of few music videos you've produced. Can you tell me a little bit about making that?
It was exciting because it was directed by George Romero, and George Romero was the original director of Night of the Living Dead, so on and so forth. So it was for me as a young man, as a young artist that always wanted to and was always interested in film, especially at the time I grew up, like horror movies were just, it was just such a great time to be young and into horror movies. So to watch George Romero work, really, really in conjunction with Jerry's vision as well, just to how he communicated with the other camera people, the way that he would take his vision and other ideas from talent, and just create, you know, all throughout my career, I've had these incredible opportunities to be able to be near these insanely talented, successful people and just sit back and watch them do their thing. So that was the experience of Scream. Even just watching the effects part of it, the makeup part of it, come to life was an amazing experience. It was an amazing process, and it taught me a lot. And so I was always just really excited to be part of it. I wish I was a better business person, but I was always really excited to just be part of the process.
Well, in reference to insanely talented people in film, you also appear in the Insane Clown Posse's movie, The Big Money Hustlers.
Right.
Can you tell me about your experience with Violent J and Shaggy 2 Dope?
Those guys were always good to me, and even to the present. All those, the Insane Clown Posse family have always been really good to me. And what I mean by that is, you know, reaching out like, hey, how are you? What's up? So you were on the road. If you need a place to stay. But again, watching those guys who were trying to create something and were doing something that was totally, totally out of the pocket, even with that film and the collection of talent that was there, the comedic side of it was awesome to watch, because on the music side, there was a lot of, you know, think about Typo Negative, think about Marilyn Manson, think about Nine Inch Nails. There was a lot of that at that time when I would step back into the music world, you know, Megadeth, like, so stepping into this, working with Insane Clown Posse and all this incredible like comedic talent was again awesome to watch and see how that was structured and composed. You know, everyone was always real good to me. Everyone was always real nice to me. You know, I get the question sometimes like who's the biggest asshole you ever met, like famous person? And it's really hard to think of who it is. I always come up like myself. Like I can come up with an example of like, I am the worst guy right now in the room. But yeah, so it was awesome. And I remember how much we laughed just filming the scene that we did with
Harlan Williams. Yeah. The Rocket Harlan Man.
Williams. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just even that dude just making that face like 37 times over and over is hysterical.
That's just what his face looks like, Michael. He can't help it.
It was great. As one thing, as a band, the Misfits, we laughed a lot. You look at pictures of us, you see us on stage, and we are serious as a heart attack, but we laughed a lot more than we scowled.
Well, around the same time for Famous Monsters, both you and the Insane Clown Posse are working with WCW, World Championship Wrestling. You and the Misfits come out with Vampiro.
Here comes Vampiro, Jerry Only, and members of the Misfits to the ring.
Vampiro would go on to work with ICP before and after that as well. Were you into wrestling at all before, even as a child, or was that an exciting thing for you, other than the obvious of you're on this big entertainment stage?
Well, I was a big WWF fan. Roddy Piper and Hulk Hogan, George the Animal Steel, Macho Man, you know, WrestleMania 1. So I was absolutely excited because a lot of those guys were in WCW. You know, they were the NWO at right, like Hulk Hogan, those they were, but Roddy Piper was around and Macho Man and old school dudes. So yeah, I was totally into it, but yeah, I wasn't a big dude, so I mean, I was into it, but kind of like, oh man, what y'all doing?
And they couldn't have been bigger in the 90s when you were around them as well, as far as like the size of wrestlers. They were just gigantic.
They were huge. I mean, even the women, like I remember, you know, in WCW when we were doing our thing, I would hang out. I just remember how big all of these guys were. They were superhuman. A lot of these, you know, most of them were obviously serious athletes, but collegiate athletes, like successful collegiate athletes, focused on their game. Huge, though, you know, like 6'2", 6'4". I Sting was in WCW, right? I did my makeup next to Sting, and that dude is like, he's huge. And I, at the time, I was, you know, with boots on, I'm like 5'10", right? And I was big at that time, about 181 pounds, which is, for me, it's huge on a 5'10 frame. You put 181, 182 pounds, but I was nothing. I was just like a pussycat to these guys. So yeah, I was stoked to be around them, but in the beginning, scared out of my mind.
At this time, when you're touring with the Misfits, and of course Doyle famously brings the weights on tour with them and things like that, are you working out also? Are you trying
every day? Every day, we treated our bodies like athletes. We looked at ourselves as musicians, but also as athletes. And we, you know, there were some people that, you know, they would laugh at that, but we did. We worked out pretty much every day. We would take off maybe, you know, a day, and then on our day off, we would stretch. We would do something. There would be some sort of regiment. But yeah. Which is also a reason that we love to tour with the hardcore bands, because the hardcore bands, these guys were vegans, vegetarians before they were vegans and vegetarians. And they didn't put things into their body that they felt were going to poison them or cloud them or do anything that would, you know, a lot of the times to reach their potential. Right. Or even at the very least, they were very conscientious to what they were putting it, you know, eating. There wasn't a lot of drugs as well, which was good because we didn't do drugs and there wasn't much alcohol at all, except for the crew. And so it was like that. We treated ourselves like athletes. Even when we went home, when I went home, you know, I continued to like off season train and make sure that my body and my mind was, especially my body. Sometimes my mind was a little wrecked, but my body was always ready to be better and faster and be able to just jump and spin and just be awesome to be a force on stage.
Do you have any fond memories of touring specifically with Earth Crisis, who are vegan and straight edge and New York hardcore and all the things you just said?
Specifically, I don't, but I loved hanging out with those guys, because very early on, those were the dudes, you know, that like Earth Crisis, H2O, those guys were talking about forever chemicals and, you know, geoengineering and, you know, Monsanto and what they were doing to modify food, like those. And this is the '90s, right? And so these conversations were happening there, and, you know, my, and so I would sit and learn about all of this and see people, which was maybe even more importantly, see people putting it to work, right? Like they were saying things that they felt and believed, and they were putting that to use in their life, right? So they would be like, you know, yeah, we're not into this and that and these chemicals. And that's how they live. They weren't just putting that out. It wasn't a front. It was what they were doing. And so there was certainly a lot of respect. I respect the New York City hardcore scene way more than I ever did the punk scene at that time, or certainly now.
Sure. And I that goes back to, I guess, just the ethos you were talking about versus the sound. You just felt more related to them and the things they stood for and their sincerity and things like that, right?
Definitely. There was a large umbrella with the hardcore scene, right? It was the large tent type of thing. And that was the punk rock ethos, especially after the, you know, like American Psycho was really the death of punk, and certainly the death of the militant part of punk rock, and the militant part of the skinhead scene died prior to Famous Monsters. And that was a good thing, because the Misfits shows, hardcore scene, like we wanted everybody to come. You didn't have to be a punk rocker. You didn't have to be a metalhead. You didn't have to, it didn't matter what you were, whatever. We wanted you to come and just enjoy the music, enjoy the creativity, right? We did tons of touring with Gwar. So that's the type of feeling that we wanted to put out as a band, as a movement, in whatever scene that we were in. But as Famous Monsters, you know, when Famous Monsters was released, and then moving forward, the punk scene that we knew and loved was had become something that even back then it was almost unrecognizable. And we saw the other bands that were touring, but the punk rock that was, you know, what was being called punk rock, we didn't fit into. You know, that's why we toured with the hardcore bands, or we could tour with a band like Famous Monsters. We went out with Megadeth on the Cryptic Writings tour, and we fit with those guys and would play with bands like that.
So finally, as far as Famous Monsters goes, the cover is is you guys, which is kind of a unique thing for the Misfits. I mean, I know it's kind of like an illustration of you, or maybe it's a photo that became an illustration, but do you remember what that thought process was and that decision being made? I mean, I think it's, of course, it's iconic for me. I had that poster on my wall, but. Right.
So Basil Gogos did the original artwork for the cover of Famous Monsters. Basil Gogos, very famous artist that had created the artwork for the Famous Monsters magazine, and the famous image of Frankenstein and the werewolf and Dracula, the creature from the Black Lagoon. So Basil Gogos was like cornerstone in the horror genre of art and movies and film. Again, the Famous Monsters, the very famous publication called Famous Monsters, that I think
Corey Taylor.
Yeah, right. Corey Taylor just acquired that property and is going to bring it back to life, which is really, really exciting. So Basil Gogos was like, you know, old school, and he created that. And he made me look like the biggest dude in the band, which I really appreciated.
Yeah, you look jacked on that picture. Absolutely.
I look really big when you look at that. I look bigger than Doyle.
You look like a superhero. And years after this album comes out, you and Chud exit the Misfits. Lots of things happen with the Misfits. But years after that, Roadrunner puts out the Roadrunner United album, and you are featured on a song called I Don't Want to Be a Superhero with Matt Heafy from Trivium, Mike D from Killswitch Engage.
Yeah.
What was the process of making that song like? Are you in the studio with all these guys? Or they send you a track? Or, you know, how's that collaboration work?
Yeah, Matt and I did studio work together. But he and I communicated, and you know, Matt from Trivium, very, very different than anything punk rock. And he didn't really listen to punk music. I mean, he's just an incredible guitarist. So we got matched up in the production of Roadrunner United, and he wanted to write a punk song. Like we wanted to write a punk song, you know, and like sort of, you know, match the genres and meld them together. And I think somebody played him Bad Religion. Like he got really into Bad Religion. Because for listeners that don't know, Matt Heafy is like a really fast player, like really, you know, technical and fast, like sweeps, just unbelievable. As opposed to a guitar player like Johnny Ramone, you know, who is a virtuoso in his own right, but totally different in how they throw the ball. Lots of down picking and not a lot of, you know, pentatonic scales and right. Sweeps and stuff.
Very meat and potatoes four chord guitar playing.
Right. Matt, he couldn't play like that if he tried. And that was the brilliance of it. So when he heard a band like Bad Religion and some of these other things that were played for him that clicked his ear, he wrote the music for what became I Don't Want to Be a Superhero. So he sent me that music. And when I heard it, I just stood up and I was like, this is incredible. It's brilliant. It's incredibly brilliant. And I said, I hope I don't screw this up.
So he had kind of made the music of the track and sent it over to you, and you guys talked like on the phone or something, kind of how the song was going to go or what his vision was for it.
He gave me the the basic tracks, the basic guitar tracks, how the song was going to be put together. It was basic guitar, it was basic drums, and he said, here you go, anything you want to do. I said, all right, you know, give me a week or so, and I'll send back my ideas.
That's awesome. And do you know if he like picked to work with you, or it was just like a draft thing? I'm not sure how all those songs worked out. Maybe you aren't either, but I just didn't know if he was like, I love the Misfits and I want Michael on the song.
Yeah. So the way that Roadrunner did it was they chose captains, and each song had a captain, and that captain was able to then recruit bass player, drummer, whoever they needed, but they had to have been on Roadrunner Records. So I think Matt was the captain and picked all the guys that put together Superhero. So yeah, he specifically said Michael Graves, because he wanted punk. He wanted to have the element of the ingredient of punk dripped into the song.
Very cool. That's awesome. Yeah, I love that song. I love that album. That's such a cool concept.
That's one of my favorite things that I ever created. I love that song.
All right, well, circling back to Famous Monsters, what is something, looking back on it now, I know you're saying that it's a miracle that it even existed, that it even was produced, but what is something, looking back on it, that you wish you would have done differently approaching that record? As much of a step up as you see it was in your confidence from American Psycho, what's something that you think could even be a step up from it with what you know now?
I don't know. I think maybe I wish I had more of a... I would have come at it with more of an idea of how I wanted to hear the sound modeled, like the overall sound of the record. I think that record sounds great, but I was really focused on content and delivery and not the sonic nature of it. And I always thought, as I do now, that, you know, Doyle and Jerry, but Doyle specifically, is one of the greatest guitar players that has ever lived. Nobody has ever played the guitar the way that Doyle plays. And I think that is one of just the way that he plays and the power of it. I wish that we had spent more time even being experimental. How do we really capture the incredible power that's behind the way that Doyle especially plays? So that I would spend more time on that, on how do we capture that? Like, how do we put that in the cage?
And what is something that is your favorite part about this record, whether it's a song, a moment making it? What's your favorite memory you can think of, or just a favorite memory? I know you probably got a lot of this period in your life besides doing your face paint next to Sting, which is my favorite moment of your life.
We had run out of time in the Woodstock studio that we were working out of in upstate New York. We were out of time at the old church. And so some of the elements of Famous Monsters had to be not only re-recorded, because we were really not happy with the way that the drums came out. So the drums in Famous Monsters, a lot of them, or I think all of them, were re-recorded, but re-recorded in a way. Ed Stasium re-recorded the drums by piping the different parts of the drums through speakers and miking the speakers. And it was crazy, but there was a lot of vocals that hadn't been recorded that needed to be recorded. So one of my favorite memories of making Famous Monsters is being in this really hot, awful room where it was me and Doyle and Chud, and we were recording the vocals to the songs that needed to be recorded. And I remember at one point we broke this, like, it was like a $5,000 microphone, because it was just so hot, and it had tubes, and it was just this really beautiful microphone, but it was so hot and just awful in the space that we were given. The microphone just gave out. And I just remember how much fun we were having and how we were trying to figure out, like, what are we going to tell them? And, oh my God, what the hell are we going to do? So it's just at that moment, again, I remember it's like a core memory we're just all laughing and we're just all, but like we're miserable because it's so hot and it's just definitely not optimal circumstances. But man, we were the happiest people in the world at that point. It's a really nice memory.
Well, that's beautiful. No laughter in the chaos. But now we come to the controversial part of the show, Michael, where you have to answer for something that you did in the past that maybe you regret, and maybe you've had to correct over and over again since it happened. But that is, why is Michael spelled the way that it is?
Well, that's the thing. I was young, probably like 15 years old, and I had this friend who was very different than everybody else. And this is like, you know, this is the 80s. And his name was Jim. And so he spelled his name J-H-I-M just because. And so, you know, I was a very rebellious, pain in the ass teenager, just always looking for ways to, if everyone's going left, well, let me figure out how to go right. So I just changed it just to be that guy, to be like, no, it's spelled M-I-C-H-A-L-E because nobody else spells it like that. Right. That was my thing. And it just stuck. And I just always spelled my name like that. But I'll tell you a funny story. The reason that I'm called Michael Graves is because my name was almost microphone. And I had to come up with an 11th hour decision to call myself anything other than microphone. So Michael Graves.
Wait, you're saying your Misfits name, much like Mike Hideous or whatever, was almost Michael Raphone?
Not even Michael Raphone. It was just going to be Mike. I walked into the Misfits lair one day, very early on, obviously. And they were like, all right, we got it. We're going to call you Microphone. Now at the time, like, you know, I kind of had a blonde moment, right? I didn't put it together. Like Microphone. I was like Mike Raphone. I grew up in Northeastern New Jersey, so there's a lot of like Italian. So I'm like, all right, Raphone, that's kind of all right, you know. But then I was driving home. I'm like, microphone, that's not tough. Like, I'm going to get killed. You can't call me microphone. So John Grimm, there's this guy, John Grimm, who was like the merch guy. And I remember talking to him. And he was like, let's just, how about Graves? Michael Graves. And I'm like, that'll do. That's a great idea. So we went back. We're like, Michael Graves is, that's who I'm going to be. That's my name. That's my name. Anything but microphone. You know, I'm this skinny 21 year old that's about to take, you know, Glenn Danzig's spot in the Misfit. If you call me microphone, I'm going to get killed.
Thank you so much to Michael for his time, and thank you for listening. As a reminder, you could have heard this early. Could have heard it weeks ago over with the Mega Meepsters over at patreon.com/meetmeepod. Please let me know what you thought of the episode on Instagram @meetmeepod. But until then, my name is Ryan Rainbow. This is Meet Meep. And yes, that's the best that I could come up with. Bye.